Today I'm with Julian Hunt at Dean Wilson Lawyers here in Brighton. Julian's an expert lawyer in divorce. Just tell us a bit about yourself, Julian, before we start our little chat today on divorce.
Okay, thank you, Duncan. So I'm a partner at Dean Wilson, as you say, in Brighton. I qualified back in 1998 and I've specialised in family law ever since. Over time, I've accrued a number of badges in the field. I'm a member of Resolution, which is an organisation of professionals committed to the constructive resolution of family disputes. I'm also a collaborative lawyer and a trained mediator. I head up the Dean Wilson Family Department. We are ranked in both the leading law directories, Chambers UK and Legal 500. I'm classed as a leading individual, and the favourite quote that I have from that, it says that I'm one of the toughest negotiators and one of the most charming men you will meet.
Just to confirm for everybody listening that you're not a complete android, you do play golf and cricket as well.
I'm very much a sportsman, definitely. That probably drives that competitive edge. So in my practice, my focus really just is to resolve and not create conflict. I do whatever I can to steer people away from a court process. So I'm always encouraging negotiations and looking to find a solution. And just in a nutshell, I adopt the approach which I think is going to best benefit the individual and then hopefully prepare them for life post-separation.
Brilliant. So we were chatting some time ago and we both read this article in the Financial Times where they were using an expression called silver splitters. Give us a little bit more background on silver splitters, Julian.
Well, that lovely expression is for those that are over 60 and choosing to part company. And they're an increasing demographic, and the figures show that the divorce rate for this sector is up 44% compared to that 15 years earlier. And I think that's a reflection of the changing society and possibly our ageing population as well. I think our 60-year-olds feel much fitter than they used to, and they have more of an idea of what they want to do in their future lives. So yes, for the over 60s, the divorce rate is on the rise, which is in contrast to the rest of the population, where for the younger demographic, the divorce rate is actually falling. Having said that, there are many in relationships who are over 60 who have actually decided not to marry.
Okay, that's interesting. What do you think the effect of perhaps that decline in marriage could
be?
Well,
it can be catastrophic. And I think, yes, since the 1970s, there has been more people that have decided to cohabit, start families, but to do so out of marriage. And one of the big common misconceptions is that people think there's such an expression as common law marriage, and there is no such thing. It does not exist. You're either married or you're not married. And for a cohabitee, this has or can have enormously adverse implications. So, for example, a cohabitee will have no claim for spousal maintenance and no claim for pension entitlements, no claim against the other person's savings. The only claim they have is in respect of property, and that is property rights, which are very narrowly defined and not based on any ground of fairness.
So are we saying that potentially one of the best ways of protecting yourselves is to get married?
Certainly, you couldn't argue that that wouldn't be the case, because you can be left in some really, really actually unfair situations. I had a case recently that I was involved in, which is a real salutary lesson. So the parties had reached 60 years of age. They'd cohabited for 30 years. The children were doing really well. They were 22 and 25. The man had just retired following 35 years in the civil service. So he had a copper-plated pension. The woman, she was a stay-at-home mother. She'd looked after the children and was now back in the workforce, but working part-time, sort of earning pin money, really. The man then brings that relationship to an end. So what happens? Well, it's outrageously unfair. So they have one, the family home was in joint names, it was fairly modest equity, £300,000 mortgage free, so that's fine, that was split equally between them based on property law. The man, how does he then transition to his next life? Well, he's got half the house. He then was able to retain his savings, which craftily had all been put in his name, were over £100,000. And then he's got a pension, which was going to give a lump sum of about £300,000. And then an ongoing pension, RPI protected, of £30,000 plus. What did the woman come out of the relationship with? £150,000. And that is beyond unfair.
Are we on the cusp of the cohabitation laws changing? I think there was there a ruling in the summer, or was it, is there something imminent?
No, there isn't. There's a movement, and I've actually petitioned my local MP, and he did bring that back up into Parliament, and there's discussion about it. But then there's been discussion about this since the turn of this century, and nothing has happened. So there is a change happening in divorce law, likely, and that's going to be divorce itself, which is just a very narrow concept. That's just a very small issue, important one, which means that you will no longer have to have a ground in support of your divorce, which can be a real bad start to the whole divorce process because you're having to lay blame on another. But sadly, cohabitation has not gone any further. So those that live in a relationship unmarried are unprotected.
Okay, so which leads us on to a really incredibly relevant point, and one that's very valid for, I guess, a lot of our clients. So a couple deciding to marry in later life, what are the key considerations, Julian?
I think for the over 60s, it is commonplace that this is not their first marriage, and it's probably characterised by both parties having a very settled financial position, whether that is good or bad, and that there will be children and grandchildren on their respective sides. So I think that brings into play some very real concerns for those. I think the concerns are once bitten, twice shy. So they've understood that things don't always work out as they plan, so they want to take a realistic approach for their new relationship. And then secondly, their immediate family and their wish to provide and protect assets for the future benefit of their children and grandchildren. So because of that, they will be likely to want to plan much more as to what would happen if that marriage didn't work out.
Okay, and specific plans?
The specific plans are prenuptial agreement.
Okay.
It's an essential part of preparing for a modern relationship. It will give them and their family protection in the event that things don't work out as they intended. So a prenuptial agreement is designed to govern the division of finances and property in the event that the relationship breaks down. So it's going to give them a peace of mind that they're protecting assets, can also support their estate planning, and it should reduce the conflict if the relationship was to fail, because the parties are exiting thinking they know what is going to happen. And if they do that, they can avoid a very costly and unseemly court battle.
I guess turning that on its head, have you had experience where parties won't agree to a prenuptial and it almost begins ends the relationship before it begins, or can that be problematic?
It can, and yes, because it's the most unromantic thing you can ever do is to plan a prenuptial agreement just prior to marriage. And to be truthful, it's often the dominant financial party that is most wishing to enter into a prenup, and it can cause difficulties. There's no two ways about it. However, especially for those that are coming into the marriage for the second, possibly third time, and they're later in life, I think with those concerns that they have and those realities, they're likely to be much more prepared to do it. And if you do a prenuptial agreement correctly, it shouldn't be a source of contention. So when I say that, I should emphasise that prenuptial agreements are not actually recognised in law, but the family court are just about moving with the times, and increasingly so, and they now will follow a prenuptial agreement if it has been done properly. And by properly, I mean that it should have been planned a long time in advance. Both parties should have had their own independent legal advice, and there must have been full financial disclosure. So that's basically to make sure that there's no concerns about duress, that one party's been forced into it, that there's no thought that actually the other party didn't know what the other party had, and if they had known, they wouldn't have done it. So you're putting all the cards on the table. You want, the court will want to know that they actually understood the implications of what they're signing up to, so they want them to have legal advice. And then the other key factor that the agreement must have is it must have fairness. If you're entering into something which is inherently unfair, the family court can just disregard it. So that's another reason why you need legal advice, to make sure that what you're agreeing is a worthwhile document and that will be followed. And if you do tick all those boxes, then there is you are very well set to achieving a financial agreement that would be upheld if it was ever tested by the court. But more importantly, both of you would know that it's going to be upheld, and you just agree to it and move on the basis of what you've agreed.
So is there any flexibility with them? Can they be altered, changed?
They should be. It's essential that they are, actually, which may sound worrying to someone thinking, oh God, I want to settle this and that's the end of it. But we can't crystal ball gaze. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. So if you want that agreement to stay fair, there has to be a mechanism for it to be reviewed. So the agreements that I will do for you will have a mechanism for things to be reviewed on certain key dates. So as we're talking about an older couple, mostly, we're not talking about children, but for the younger couples, if there was a child, then that agreement should be reviewed because the obligations change. But otherwise, there could be reviews when there's big changes in a financial situation. You're buying property. What should happen to that next property? How should that fit into what you've already agreed? And then just with the natural lapsing of time, so within 2 to 5 years, you look at the agreement again. So it's just constantly evolving, because if you allow it to evolve, it's going to be fairer. And it's going to show the court that both of you are still looking into it. So why shouldn't you be held to it at the end?
Okay, brilliant. So what other strategies might you employ to protect assets?
Well, once again, thinking about the generational aspect that we're looking at, outside of marriage, first of all, actually, so there might be that the couple don't want to marry. They might enter into a living together agreement. So we can actually fix up an agreement which sets out the base upon which they want to live together, and also, if the relationship didn't work, how they want to separate the finances. And that would be a document that they would sign between them. So that would protect those that aren't married. And actually, just introducing another key change actually that's happened in the legislation recently is that civil partnerships have now opened up since December of 2019 to opposite sex couples, whereas before it was for same sex couples. And if you enter into a civil partnership, you get the same protection as if you were married, but you don't have to go through the ceremonial aspect of marriage. And so it may well fit more to a different aspect of the community. And then your question to me was, what other ways can you sort of protect assets? And certainly you can think about placing assets in trust for your children. So this is going back to this idea that you've elder, more advanced years couple, they've already got assets that they've accrued and they want to benefit their children and grandchildren. So they might want to put them in trust. And that can be an effective way to get that out of the marriage, as it were.
Okay. On a slightly pessimistic note, can we just consider what happens if the marriage fails without a prenup?
So, yes, if your marriage fails without a prenup, the outcome is governed by the Matrimonial Causes Act 1973. So a very old piece of legislation. And with this piece of legislation, both the beauty and the beast of the Act is that it all boils down to a discretionary exercise. It works within guidelines which are always open to different interpretations. So the beauty of that, I would suggest, is that it's designed to achieve fairness. So that's the real beauty of it. And that contrasts to many continental Europe legal systems, where they have a formulaic system, and that can result in some great unfairness. The beast of it, however, is that discretion means uncertainty as to outcome, and that gives scope for litigation.
So I guess a question that you must get initially a lot, and that I hear, in terms of the splitting of finances on divorce, give us some background on that, Julian.
So, starting point that the court will look at is equality. They'll review each case to see whether an equal division of the assets would be fair to the parties. But that's just a starting point. And then you can depart from equality, and if there is to be a departure of equality, you take into account the particular circumstances of the case. Now, they prescribe what these circumstances are, and they are things such as, what are the income and earning capacities of each party? What are the financial needs and obligations for each party? What are the parties' ages and health? What's the length of the marriage been? What have the contributions been? What's one party brought in? What's the other party brought in? What's the standard of living been like during the marriage? Now, all of those factors are listed, but they're not numbered. So they all go into the mix. So one is not necessarily got any more weight than the other. And it's just a balancing exercise to work out then what should be a fair outcome. And equality, in any event, is not always a certainty in any situation, because needs can trump equality. So you can have situations where one party is the dominant earner and has the dominant amount of assets. And actually, because of that, particularly the dominant income, the person with the more concerning financial situation gets more, because that higher earner will have a greater mortgage capacity and ability to regenerate their financial situation. So there's a lot of factors to be taken into account.
I guess, interestingly, people will frequently want to lay blame for the end of a relationship. And I guess, is there a misconception that blame can influence the distribution of assets or payout?
It's a complete misconception. It plays no part whatsoever to the outcome. As I alluded to earlier, they're actually about to change the divorce law, so fault won't even come into it at all. It's impossible for a judge to decide what has actually happened in the marriage and is the true cause to the breakdown of the relationship. So it just becomes a financial determination. Having said that, there is a slightly different way of where conduct can become an issue, but it's exceptional. So that's not necessarily the cause for the breakdown of the marriage, but it might be the conduct of the party during the marriage. So one party may have squandered extraordinary amounts of money through bad behaviour or addictions. Can the other person say, well, actually, because of that, I should receive more of what are the remaining assets? And the answer is, often you take your spouse for how you find them. And it's most unlikely that that will be taken into account. So we had a case not long ago in the papers where there was this hedge fund trader that on occasion could earn vast sums of money, but he also had a very interesting lifestyle and lived the high life, should we say, and spent eye-watering sums on nefarious activities that he shouldn't have done. And then also, the divorce came at a moment when the crash had happened and he was suddenly doing far worse. And the judge said, no, you took your spouse for how you found him. And okay, he had bad periods, but he also had exceptional periods. So in the round, it balanced itself out. And you can take a view as to whether that was a fair judgment or not.
So people feeling that they can evidence a history of unreasonable behaviour should have no expectation that that would influence any settlement.
It has to be exceptional.
Okay.
Very, very narrow. So we would try ordinarily be steering people away from... I can understand where they come from and I can empathise and sympathise, but ultimately it's unlikely to have any effect on the outcome.
Okay. Another consideration which often arises. If one party was, say, living overseas or working overseas, what are some of the issues this creates?
It can cause real issues for the party trying to discover assets of the other and to get people in the other spouse to properly engage in the process. And it might be that she has to or he has to go to the court here to get orders compelling that person to comply. And there have been instances where that has been almost impossible to obtain. There have been some cases where actually it just hasn't been possible. So, especially with The cases that often go to the court are those that are very wealthy, so obviously this doesn't apply to everyone, but in a case not long ago, there was a husband living in the Middle East that was refusing to engage whatsoever, and he was worth eye-watering sums. And what the court decided to do was to order every single asset held in England to the wife, and just take a view that the husband could afford to pay for it, because he must have assets that he hasn't disclosed overseas. So they're the tricky cases. But otherwise, in the usual run of things, then it makes no difference that a person is living overseas, and it should be the court process can follow just that person coming in for the court hearings, and the orders can apply to overseas assets where necessary.
Okay. I think you alluded to this point a little bit earlier, but just give us a bit more detail on the situation where one party is a much larger earner, or, well, I suppose off the back of that, or off the back of assets, they've been financing the lifestyle that the couple have been enjoying. What happens then?
So this comes back to this discretionary exercise. So there's no hard and fast rule for this, but if you were to say in general, we have a couple that have lived together for a long period of time. One party's been the breadwinner and the other party's been the homemaker. The judges are absolutely clear that they make no distinction between the breadwinner and the homeowner. And the homeowner should not be in any way disadvantaged. So there's often a case that's cited where there was this paper magnate in Kent, who was worth about £22 million, thought that he'd generated all the money himself. The children had left the nest, decided that between them the marriage would end, and he said, well, I'm worth £22 million, so I'm going to give my wife £4 million, because that's more than she needs. And the wife said, no, I made an equal contribution to this partnership. You may have been the breadwinner, but I looked after the children, kept the home for you. I want £11 million. And it went to final hearing. I don't think this chap decorated himself in any glory at all. And I think he called his wife a trophy wife that he'd wheel out for the occasional dinner party. She may have imbibed too much alcohol on those occasions and not represented him the way that he wanted. And the court said, no, this is not appropriate. Your children... She was active in looking after your children. You're not exceptional. You've done nothing amazing. You've just made a lot of money. You will pay her £11 million plus the lawyer's costs to get there, which were eye-watering sums. So the only real people that can get a departure from equality are people such as Sir Paul McCartney, people that have done something extraordinary. If they have had this stellar contribution, then they may get a departure from equality. Otherwise, we're looking at equality.
So is that a salient lesson in potentially how business assets can be split?
Business assets can cause complexities, but there are issues about whether they are liquid, and there's often a sort of tension between them possibly being double counted. So you've got the value of the company, but then if you've got the income that company produces, and the income then is often going to produce the spousal maintenance that's going to be payable post-separation. So the spouse can't seek both the income from the future income from the business by what it generates through the husband's or wife's income, and then also the capital value of the company. Because if you're seeking the capital value of the company, well, the company needs to be sold to achieve it. And then you're probably taking the income stream away. So there's always a tension about how you deal with the assets, a business asset. And I think the focus is, are we looking at the income stream this produces or the capital value of it? But it is taken into account. It isn't ignored. It's not hived off as a separate excluded asset.
Okay. I guess another asset which can play quite a large part... in terms of the total mix, would be pension entitlements or pensions that have been accrued to date. Just give us some detail or background as to how those are considered and split.
Okay, so nowadays you can get pension sharing orders. So that allows a pension to be split and to go to the other spouse. And what basis is that split? Once again, it's through this discretionary exercise, But if you've had a long marriage and you've taken different roles in that marriage, then it might be that there will be a split of the pension, possibly on a 50-50 basis. And there's often the need to get a pension actuary involved to work out, actually, what is equality in this? And that's the real tricky thing with pensions. Different actuaries value their own pensions differently. And there's different types of pensions. You've got your money purchase pensions or your final salary pensions. And so you often need a pension actuary to go in to get to understand the true value of these pensions so that they can decide how they are divided.
Okay. I guess perhaps not so common, but something that I've certainly seen are situations where one party perhaps is a beneficiary of a trust, and the question then is, does that count as a marital asset, doesn't it, or how do you consider it? What's the situation with those, Jim?
Can be really complicated, and it can cause some very lengthy and expensive litigation. It depends really whether that trust is a sham trust or not. So within the family proceedings, that is probably what's going to be investigated. Is this actually a sham trust? And in contested proceedings, if that is the allegation, orders can be made for the pension trustees to actually attend a court appointment to be cross-examined.
So when you're saying sham trust, what do you mean by sham trust?
That money really is being held for the exclusive benefit of the spouse in question.
Okay.
Or is it actually a trust that's been properly created? It is fully discretionary, and the trustees have their own real decisions as to how they want to distribute that trust. And therefore, if that was to be the case, if it was a properly created trust, and the trustees have obligations to other than just this exclusive beneficiary and can show that they have their own thoughts as to how that trust should be distributed, it can be ignored.
Okay.
And can be treated as a non-family asset.
Okay. That's been 9.5 hours of brilliantly insightful stuff, Julian. Is there anything else that sort of come to mind whilst we've been talking that you think may be relevant to this whole sort of divorce in later life situation?
No, I don't think so. But for the sort of the generation that we've been sort of trying to focus on, the silver setters, prenuptial agreements, really important.
Okay. Fantastic. Thanks for your time. I think it's a really hugely beneficial podcast for all our listeners. And thanks again, Julian.
Pleasure. Thank you, Duncan.